Matrix. I'm Jonathan, and I'm left of center.
And I'm Rich, and I tend to lean a little bit more to the right. But the bottom line is together we try to look for the balance of what it means to be human in today's world.
All right, let's get started. Welcome to Living in the Matrix, everyone. I'm Jonathan. This is my co-host, Rich. Say hello, Rich.
Hey, everybody. Happy 4th of July. Happy 4th of July weekend. Looking forward to having a great time and celebrating our great nation. Cheers.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting living in the times because we are kind of in a unique time. I'm glad you started that. I love the 4th of July. I think it's probably one of the most interesting holidays we have. But we have sort of an interesting season that we're in. And one of the things that we're going to do today is we're going to talk about three or four topics. We love these topic conversations because they really bring out a lot of really interesting thoughts. And so the first one we want to dive into is we just had a debate.
My question for you is, how are you incorporating these developments into your decision to stay? And separately, what concerns do you have about Vice President Harris's ability to beat Donald Trump if she were at the top of the ticket?
Look, I wouldn't have picked Vice President Trump to be vice president, but I think she's not qualified to be president. So let's start there. Number one, the fact is that the consideration is that I think I'm the most qualified person to run for president. I beat him once, and I will beat him again.
What do you think, Rich?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, obviously his performance was abysmal. There was a point in time when people were just kind of cringing and feeling sad. And I looked over at Trump and he's just like, all of a sudden, then he like looks back and he goes, "What?" And in one moment he goes, "I don't understand what Joe just said. And I don't think he knows what he just said." And there was, what's sad for me is that Trump, at first was very lucid and eloquent and went to the issues. And then he just started talking about himself, right? By the end of the night, it appeared after a break, he kind of had a little bit of a resurgence, got back into it, but then he finished very poorly. That's what I understood. And there was a lot of interspersed of stuff in there.
Are you talking about Biden or Trump?
No, I'm talking about Biden overall was an abject failure, right? Everybody knew after that, that it wasn't good. And here's what's really sad and scary. CNN at the end of that said, okay, guys, after the debate, please tell us the audience of CNN who won that debate. And it was 67% Trump and 33% Biden. And for those 33% of the people out there, that is just either you're ignorant, you're stupid, naive, or you just are holding on to some kind of threat of something, because that's so disingenuous. Because he wasn't functioning as a human. There was nothing to vote for in that particular person. For that 33% to say, yeah, I'm still casting my vote for Biden, I think that what they meant was I'm casting my vote for the Democratic Party. That's my observation.
Yeah, they'll typically say 40% will vote Democratic or Republic. So you have two groups of 40 and you have about 20 that's sort of the float. I think we're seeing a lot of people realize. Here's the thing. You and I are polar opposites on this regard. I don't like Biden at all. I think Biden's a puppet, but I think Trump is a menace. And I think Trump is, and you think completely opposite, but I think here's an interesting point for the Democrats, because I'm not really a Democrat. I'm more of an independent. I don't like politics at all, but it's necessary. Biden is at a loss. He's at a point functionally that I think we're watching the Democrats go off a cliff. And what I think is going to happen, at least in the dialogue, is that someone like Michelle Obama or Gavin Newsom is going to step in at the convention. It's just wild how this whole season of politics has played out, because at the debate, you began to really see, oh, the traditional idea is Joe can beat Trump at debate. He couldn't do that. He could, in other, because Trump didn't say anything at the debate. That's his shtick. He didn't say anything. He lied incessantly, but that's his deal. That's who he is. And I think people just deal with that. Whereas
he lied about the border. The border is being overrun, bro, Jonathan. He's not lying about that. He's not lying about...
The fact checkers couldn't even keep up with him. It was so bad. And I think you ignore that. Yeah. But the point here is that Trump's not the one in problem. Trump won because Biden looked like he was ready for the retirement home.
That's fair. I agree with that. Yeah. I agree with that. Trump didn't come out eloquently on his own. Did he come out like right? So the question is, am I voting for this candidate because I love them, because I fear them, or I believe in them, or am I voting for them because I hate the other opponent? Right. We always want it to be a positive experience, right? I'm voting for this person because they bring hope and change, let's say, right? And this person just brings hate and division, right? And so I'm voting for the positive side of things instead of like, that other guy is so bad, I hate that person, that's why I'm voting for him. Our candidate sucks, but you know, what else are you going to do? So anyway,
did you want to play a clip? Or how do you feel about it?
What do you mean? As an American citizen?
In terms of where we are at as a country, you're an American citizen, and this is our presidency. How do you feel about this is all we have at the top?
So I'm going to say something that I think we've fleshed out before and might have even brought up on our last episode with Davidson. And one of the things, and what you and your son brought up midweek, and it's about neoliberalism and the defeat of neoliberalism and how Trump separated from that. And you said, well, yeah, he did break away. And so one of the things I have to get out there in the front and say, Trump is not the swamp. Trump is not an Obama.
No, I don't think
he is. He's not a Bush. He's not. Reagan was different, but he's not any of the Bushes. He's not a Clinton. He's not Obama, and he's not a Biden. This is a guy who's built things his whole life and definitely declared bankruptcy and has been known to be an egotist and a narcissist and a playboy, right? But he came in, and this is undeniable. This is what kills me, Jonathan. He met with Kim Jong-un. He freaking kept China at bay. He likes, and Putin likes him. And he basically kept us out of world wars, right where we are. Mm-hmm. Economic prosperity, unemployment, border safe. He did the things that that people didn't like on the left, because he actually walked the walk and talked the talk. Now, one of the things he didn't do is he didn't build the wall. He said he was going to do it. He said he was going to make Mexico pay for it. That's the one promise that I think he said that he didn't come to fruition on. He was going to start an infrastructure project. He builds. He was looking forward to making our infrastructure better again. He actually helped out with the Rust Belt. He didn't have a chance. He lost the election. It takes 10 years to rebuild the
Biden
country.
Biden did it in his first 4 years.
Biden doesn't done shit. Have you seen the infrastructure? Our bridges are collapsing. Our dams are collapsing.
The largest infrastructure bill signed ever. So we got to start there.
It was on the heels of Trump. That's what Trump was putting in place. Who's the builder, Jonathan? Is it Biden or is it Trump? Trump is the contractor. Trump built
skyscrapers. I'm not here to defend Biden. So I think the point is –
okay, let's take a step. I'll take a step back. I've had a dart this morning. I had nicotine and coffee, which I've never really had those conversations on our podcast before. Let's go back. He would have won again, except for COVID. Everybody knows this. He was at a 52% approval rating, and then COVID came and blew everything up. And this is what's really so sad, is that we've exposed that this country only wants what makes them feel good and comfortable about walking in the walk and talking the talk and towing the line. And once you realize that Biden did nothing, and everybody looks in the mirror and says, I'm not better off than I was 4 years ago, which is undeniable. Whether a guy goes on the Walmart website and says, I just looked at my old shopping cart from 2 years ago, and I paid for groceries for an entire month, and it was $114. And I had the ability to go in there today and hit reorder, and it's $450. Mm-hmm. If people don't understand that the policies that he's put in place, including people getting raped and people getting killed and entire lawlessness happening, this wasn't happening under Trump's watch. And yet here's what people are still saying. Let's give Biden a chance. And this is what just absolutely blows my mind. It's the absolute matrix.
Let me give you a counterpoint to the same matrix. Okay. One, Biden didn't raise prices. Corporations did. So I think it's disingenuous.
His policies, no, his economic policy put it in place.
Why is a policy going to raise prices? How do you make that correlation?
It's called printing money. Talk to the Federal Reserve.
That I agree with. Okay.
But
businesses raise prices. I'll give you a counterexample. Arizona Tea. Are you familiar with it? They're of on course. The hot seat right now because they refuse to raise the price on a can from 99 cents to a higher rate. He's never raised his price in 19 years. And it's very easy to say, oh, Washington. See, when Trump was in and he raised gave a $2 trillion tax break and it's hurting the middle class, nobody complained. You don't count that part. That's the problem I have to deal with is, help me understand why you think Trump is so great when you've ignored that he's done just as much. That's my point is the debate
the
shows
fiscal policy. No, Jonathan,
a total shit show and a guy who cannot think.
You're talking in academics and the people were actually better off. Academics. Absolutely. You're talking in theory about like tax cuts and how the middle class sucked and everybody was
that's
fucking
fact,
happy.
He gave everybody was happy. $2 trillion tax cut to the wealthy. Do you disagree with that?
Go up to 100, dude, all the wealthiest have gotten even more wealthy now.
Do you
now
agree
under Biden.
That he created that tax cut? Let's start there.
I agree. And guess what? Okay. It benefited everybody.
Okay.
Dude, are you
it has
dude,
no
ask 100
on
people in small town Arkansas. Ask 100 people in small town Arkansas if those tax cuts fucked them over 4 years ago. They're going to go, please take us back to 4 years ago because we're paycheck to paycheck. I can't actually pay my bills now. My farm is done. Everybody is looking at this and what you're saying, you're putting this up on the chalkboard in terms of equations and about tax cuts and fiscal policy. Mm-hmm. And everybody's looking at you in the face right now and they're saying, I don't care what
no, they're
you
not,
say.
Bro. No,
everything
not.
Was better. Everything
Come
was
on.
Better 4 years ago. Jonathan, everything was better 4 years ago. Nobody,
no, it wasn't.
There's nobody.
No, it wasn't.
Only the trillionaires. Only the trillionaires.
Here's my point. Okay. Here's my point. As a debate, it showcased two really important things. And this is my point. You know, I don't like Trump and you don't like Biden. We're clear on that. But yeah. Here's the reality. Both candidates suck. And here's why. Biden is I think Biden in history will show up better than Trump long term. Okay. But that's neither here nor there. That's neither here nor there. Okay. That's
that
just
is,
a conjecture. It's pure conjecture. Okay.
Pure imagination. Yes.
Okay. But you don't have that imagination because you're so locked into Trump, bro. Here's my point. We have two candidates that are both shit shows. And here's why. Okay, let me give you the point of why.
Tell me why.
Biden is clear. I'm not a Biden fan. Biden, faculties wise, it's time for him to retire. It's pretty clear. But during those 4 years that Trump was a president, the United States was in utter chaos. And that's my point is you lift Trump up to this point that it's going to make the country a better country. It has no historical precedence for doing that. And it ended with January 6th, which is sort of the capstone of saying, this is exactly what Trump brought. And that's my point, is
and
we
you
are-
believe that January 6th was a real thing.
Shit-shows.
All the facts that you're getting with January 6th, where the Supreme Court is saying, we're going to probably throw out all of the injunctions against them that you've got ghost buses showing up on the day. There's
pipe
bombs
being planted.
The fact is
January 6th happened when he was there.
Nancy Pelosi was in charge of the National Guard and she failed to deliver.
So Trump didn't have any responsibility to it.
Not the way that the Speaker of the House did.
The leader of the country didn't have any responsibility?
He asked for
it. You want to give him.
He asked
you
for
don't
it.
Want to atone. My point is not that, like, you're not winning a counter argument. I agree with you. Biden sucks. I'm sad that we are in a point in history where this is the best we got. That's my point.
I kind of agree with that, what our options are. But one of the things that the Democrats don't understand is they hated Trump for his causticness. And imagine a father who raises his kids and they all end up being really well, but he tells coarse jokes and he farts in public and, you mm-hmm. know, he's not very cultured and people look at him like some kind of pariah. And then you watch his freaking, you know, he's got a good household in order. His kids grow up to be great, maybe a little rough around the edges, but they end up being good citizens in the world. And everybody goes, oh yeah, that guy was, he was a terrible father. He was a terrible guy. And behind the scenes, everything was fine. That's the difference between Trump and Biden. People don't like him for his, you know, his making fun of women and calling them horse faces and all of the narcissistic things. Mm-hmm. But if you look and you peel back the onion, when you look at keeping peace relatively strong, keeping jobs and unemployment low, keeping, you know, the idea of, I don't know. It just, to me, there were so many things that he accomplished along the way. That's why people are looking back and they're going, my God, if we could just have that back again. And
do you want to go back to the chaos? Do you think we are more chaotic or less chaotic?
I don't know what chaos you're talking about. The entire right now is the most chaotic we've ever seen. There are people across the world who are looking at this country right now. Yeah. They're being interviewed.
And they're going, what the hell happened to you? Completely different page.
Yeah. What the hell happened to America? Right? I mean, that's what's I truly believe that the deep state has put things in place to make us less of a strong nation. And it is true. We are less safe and less healthy than we've ever been at any point in time in our history, as of right now.
That is something I completely that to me is the matrix, is we have this issue of the Obamas, the Clintons, and his Nancy Pelosi's, who have created this sense of organization to say we're going to neoliberal. I think that's what it ultimately comes down to, is neoliberalism tried to control Washington to such a degree. Mm. And Trump came in, and if Trump did anything, he disrupted that. He did not drain the swamp.
He and did I not. Think, fair.
Okay. Fair.
That's fair.
We are still in a shit show. And I think that has to do with bigger things, but the matrix still exists in Washington as neoliberalism trying to control this way of operating that says, hey, there's the elite and then there's everybody else. So there's money and then there's everybody else. And we are not fiscally, financially, economically, socially in a better place than we were 4 or 8 years ago. I do not think Trump added to the value, but I can't say Biden did as well. Biden has been a puppet to neoliberalism. And I think to that point is my point of this topic, or at least what I wanted to get out of it, was how do you think we as a country get out of this hole? And what I hear you saying is it's more of the same, which is Trump. Because I don't think either of them are the answer.
Okay. What I was actually going to say is at the beginning was, now that you've watched this, what is the course of action for the Democrats? Because we already know what the course for the Republicans is. It's going to be Trump all the way, and it always has been.
Yeah.
But you've got people spinning their heads around saying, is it going to be Newsom? Is it going to be Michelle? Is it going to be Gretchen Whitmer? Because they're talking about a couple other people on the ticket too. Is it going to be Kamala, right? People are talking about, is it going to be Kamala? And when you look at Kamala, the montages of Kamala make it go like, oh God, this should get eaten alive. Well, so that's actually how I wanted it. Yeah.
On top of that, I think Kennedy splits the Democratic ticket.
Splits it in half? I think that's enough.
It's enough that Trump has a clear lead. And now after that was the point of the debate, is the debate shifted people's perceptions of Biden to such a degree that it became a talking point. And when it's a talking point, it's like, remember, what was the name of that? Howard Dean. Remember Howard Dean? He lost because of that talking point. And we're there now with Biden.
Well, he also got that. His one thing was like he just got really fired up on, he went, on camera. And that was like, dude, this guy's unhinged. But going back, just to be fair to me, I told you and Davidson, I loved Andrew Yang. I loved his ideas. I could have voted for that man, right? Even though it was Trump going there ultimately. And I originally wanted to vote for Marco Rubio because he just came across as a much more polished candidate. And then unfortunately, I'm not a Trump worshiper. I'm not a Trump worshiper. I want you to understand that. I could have voted for Andrew Yang.
You defend him pretty vehemently, though.
I know. It's because he's what we had. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, and I've told Davidson, I've said this before on podcasts and I've told other people, that I really liked Andrew Yang. He came across both aisles, and I liked some of the things he was talking. He liked nuclear power. He was on Fox and Friends. I also liked RFK Jr. I think he's got a lot of important things, and he's helping people break away, right? One of the things that RFK and Trump do, and my God, can you imagine them as a team, would be they are the dystopian. No, they're not dystopian. They're the ones that are opening the matrix up, right? They're saying peel back the matrix and let's see what the real world is and let's really roll up our sleeves and dig in. That would be an amazing, for me, I would love to see something like that, right?
Wait, what do you mean?
We'll see.
In terms of
if RFK back- became his, if RFK became his like ticket, if it was Trump and RFK, imagine the what they could do.
RFK would never do that.
I know, and Trump wouldn't either. No. I know.
And I think,
but he's not a Dem. He's not a Democrat, right? He's not a Democrat.
He could be. I think as a Hail Mary, the first Hail Mary is to Michelle or Gavin Newsom. I think that's the talk, at least what I hear. But I don't think Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom's an interesting card. I think he's a terrible governor. But
thank you for
he's
being
got enough cachet.
Yeah.
That, and he's also a Pelosi. So
yes.
Yeah. Which and that's the problem is the Democratic Party. I was talking, the Democratic Party is fucked. They really are. They're kind of in a really shitty situation right now. And I think given Kennedy, Kennedy splits the Democratic ticket because I think Kennedy pulls from the Democratic Party much more historically than the Republican Party.
Ross Perot pulled from G.H.W. Bush, and that's why G.H.W. Bush lost. And then, of course, Clinton. Yep, you got it. Yeah, I agree. That's the same kind of scenario going on.
Yeah. All right. Let's switch topics. I want to show you this video. Or did you watch it?
Yeah. The show. Show it. Yeah. This is AI, baby. What is it? AI.
All right. So let me. I'll let you listen to it again.
Yeah.
Work optional. Yes.
Will you work?
I'll try to work. Yes. Now, this may sound great, but I think there will perhaps be a crisis of meaning. If the AI can do everything that you can do, but better, then what is the point of doing things? So that's, I think there will be a bit of a sort of existential crisis of why do anything.
It will be like the Roman Empire, at the peak of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, with AI and robots. I think we're headed to an age of abundance. I think we're at the most interesting time in history. So, you know, that's supposedly some proverb that says, may you live in interesting times as a curse. And we live in the most interesting of times.
So what Elon Musk is proposing is this idea that if you have all 30 million robots, that's what he estimates in the next 3 to 5 years. He's going to have 30 million Tesla robots in the workforce. They're going to be between $10,000 and $20,000. And it's going to create an age of abundance because people are going to have to work. But what's interesting about that, especially as a man, what happens if you don't have to work?
Yeah.
And he calls it an existential crisis. What do you think about that?
Well, the guy in there mentioned the Roman Empire, the peak of the Roman Empire, right? The same thing happened with Alexander the Great. The famous quote that Alexander the Great did when he had almost the entire world as we know it, all the way out to Persia, all the way out to England. Mm-hmm. And when he realized he had no worlds to conquer, Alexander wept, right? That's a famous line, yeah. Alexander wept. And there's a drink actually in Portland, Oregon at a great bar. So one of the immediate things that comes to mind is when we lack purpose, teleology, then things get really bad. The things we've been seeing as men are becoming more, trying to become more masculine and trying to actually overcome the Homer Simpsons and the Al Bundys and the pejorative masculine framework that Hollywood has been giving us is like, dude, we got to come back. We've got to have kids. We got to support. We got to provide. We got to be healthy. And you're seeing a lot of stoicism and stuff. Mm-hmm. Having that purpose and meaning, when you take that away from people, they either become dependent on drugs and sedation, or they go out and they become violent and destructive, right? When a man has no purpose, and it's kind of like what Janis Joplin says is, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose, right? Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Imagine when there was a word in a movie that says, if somebody's got nothing else left to lose, then that's a dangerous person, right? And it's also, what do you have to gain? So that could be the prescription, Jonathan, in my mind, for a terrible formula of either on one side, depending on what you're tapped into, complete sedentariness and drug-induced like opioids and stuff, and there's no more point, or it's like, I'm going to go out there and fucking take out the world. I'm going to take these robots out. I'm going to just, it's going to be subterfuge. It's going to be the resistance, right? There's going to be an uprising. And so it's, I would see those two things balancing against each other in that worldview.
Do you agree with his premise that we're going to have a crisis of meaning? Because I do. I think that's
the absolutely result, you know? No. That's not any purpose. The crisis of meaning is the idea of purpose of teleology. Yeah. 100%, we're going to have a crisis, and how would we address that? Right, in light of all those things going on. Now, I'm going to tell you what's crazy is I pulled up ChatGPT and I said. Mm-hmm. I said, my question is, if AI is going to take over our jobs and do things better than we can do, what will our purpose be? And right. It goes, well, human, you know, focus on creativity and innovation. As AI handles routine tasks, humans may have more opportunities to engage in creative, innovative work, which is harder for AI to replicate. Interpersonal skills, jobs requiring emotional intelligence, empathy, and social interaction, mm-hmm. ethics and oversight, societal impact, et cetera, adaptation strategies, and how do you do that? So it tried to give me, you know, a ChatGPT 4.0 version of why there's still going to be some, you know, opportunities for us. But I'd love to ask you, in light of both of us agreeing on this existential crisis, what are our options and how do we prepare for that?
Well, I think you and I have talked a lot because we talked to my son a lot about this. We're always talking about what is the black swan. And mm-hmm. the black swan is the unknown. Matt, like 9/11 was a black swan. It's the thing that comes out of left field that captures us completely by surprise. We did not anticipate it. You know, there may have been signs, but nobody could see it. I think this is has the setup for a black swan that is profound. And here's why. In scripture, in Genesis 3, when God describes the curses, mm-hmm. work is the male curse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The toil of the fields. So in other words, the very existential crisis a man can encounter is having meaningful work, and it's never going to be enough. So imagine if you take that to the nth degree and say, hey, you don't even have to work. And so the very thing that provides you at least some form of meaning is gone. I think that's a black swan of an order of magnitude of the cross. Something's dying.
Wow.
I do. Because you're fundamentally addressing the very core problem of a man. Guess what, man? You don't have to work anymore. Well, wait a minute. That's how I create my identity, by what I do. What do men do? Hey, what do you do for a living? That's the number one question men ask each other. What do you do for a living? Now take that away and do that worldwide. Wow. Think about it.
You know what's interesting, Jonathan, is that you know who that guy Rowe is, right? Mike Rowe, the guy did Dirty Jobs.
Yeah. Dirty Jobs.
Brilliant. We've talked. He's been on podcasts. He's been on shows where he talked about there's like 15, 20 million men out there who can work, who are actively disengaged already. But the other thing that I want to ask you is
Gen Z disengaged.
Totally. But there's about 30% of the workforce is women now. I mean, since we've had women's lib and rights and we've allowed that kind of freedom to take place, it's pretty safe to say that I think there's a good 30, 40% of the workforce is women now. So if they take away those jobs and it's not just the men anymore, because we've changed that a little bit. It's not just, I mean, we're not talking 1950s, right? Where the guy's going out pounding the pavement for the mom, bringing home the TV dinners and she's cooking. That paradigm has changed dramatically. So maybe will the crisis be less existential? Because going back to Black Swan, I think COVID was a Black Swan for us. That is, I mean, people are still reeling today.
Yeah,
I think people are reeling more from COVID. As a humanity, we're reeling more from COVID than, of course, the world is from 9/11. That affected us and some Middle Eastern areas. But I think
it's the first. I agree. COVID, here's my take on COVID. COVID was the first time in history that we contracted from productivity.
Yes.
So the work model, I live in Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley is all about productivity and how do you increase it for the sake of the dollar. COVID was the first time we took a step back functionally and sent people home and said, don't work. And they're like, holy shit, this is actually really good. I'm getting to know my kids again. And it broke a spell. Yeah. So I completely agree with you that COVID was the black swan that started the process. But where it's going is, and I'll be sort of hyperbolous, I think we're in the apocalypse. Because if you take away the root of work from a man, and you say, and here's the other part of that video, is it leads to abundance. Robotics is leading to abundance because they're going to be able to do everything for us. And I know people don't like Elon, but I think Elon's youth in South Africa made him realize that he's not the tyrant people think he is. He's trying to solve world problems. And I think he understands this AI thing is going to be functionally different, because here's another part of it. AI is smarter than every human being already. Mm-hmm. So imagine what that does to a Stanford professor who is no longer the smartest cat in the room. Remember Good Will Hunting, when Will came along and the mathematicians like, holy shit, this kid's smaller than me. I'm nothing. That is the existential crisis that's going to happen globally. Yeah. Think about that. What happens when you take away work from men? You fundamentally take away the mechanism that they derive their identity from. I don't think women are going to struggle with the same, because that's not their curse. That's not their drive. Their drive is much more around experience, childbearing, being a mom, being a woman. Work came along really. I think it's great women can work. I have nothing again. I think they should be paid equally, but it's, I don't think that's their driver the way it is for masculine, for men. And I think that's what's going to change, is we're going to have to reorient. If I don't have to wake up anymore, where does most of our stress come from? From work. And then COVID showed us what happens if you go home. You can actually start working on your family, working on your marriage. So I think there's going to be a sub benefit, but I think globally we're going to have a very significant existential crisis. And that, what I think,
I just looked something up.
What?
This is going to blow your mind. And I, this is why I'm going back to, I think it might be less as existential of a crisis. I mean, I think for me it would be, but what do you suppose the workforce average for women in the workforce is for the globe as opposed to the United States?
What's in America, what's the, like 51% now?
46%.
Yeah.
Of the population. Mm-hmm. So what I'm telling you is it's almost half. Almost half of the people working in the United States in the workforce are women. Now, you just said that's not their job.
Graduates, so it's only going to increase.
Yeah. And for the globe, it's 40%. It's 39.4. Mm-hmm. Now, this is 2022. So by the way, I think it's probably gone up since then.
Yeah.
So what I'm asking you is, knowing those statistics and what the reality is, why is it that women are not going to be as affected if they've already been shown to be half the fucking workforce, at least in the United States? They're going to be displaced too.
Because work is not their driving means of meaning. In other words, the curses are, for men, it's work. Men derive their identity. Women don't go to parties and go, what do? They don't. And so what's happening is we've talked a little bit about this, of the flipping of the poles. Mm-hmm. We have been a masculine age for 6,000 years. What happens if that flips? Because post AI, the most valuable asset you can have is empathy. Because AI can't do empathy.
This is correct.
It cannot create physiological connection. And that's what women are really good at. I think what we're going to see is men going, okay, because think about it. If I don't have to work and I have enough abundance to have enough food, shelter, clothing, like I have sustenance. If we can eliminate poverty, because poverty is the primary driver of stress in American society or most global society. Poverty is the lack of care for myself on a daily basis. If you remove that problem, and now people can functionally say, I don't have to work. I have enough to eat. I have enough clothes, because I don't need 17 million pieces of clothing. I need enough to wear today. You take care of all of those primary issues. You've created the possibility of either absolute fucking chaos or the birth of a new civilization. And I think that's where we're at. I think we're at a birth where the feminine energy is going to rise to balance the masculine out. It's not going to take over because women don't want to take over. They say they do, but they really don't. It needs balance because we've been way too balanced towards the masculine. And pulling away work directly addresses that. And it forces men to say, where is my identity as a human being? And it can't be just in work.
So I want to make a little bit, it's not necessarily an argument, but it's an observation. Sure. So yeah. Are you the one who sent me this video about this guy who lives in Asia? And he goes, I live by the ocean. I've got all these things. These people are wondering why we're so much a slave to society here.
I don't remember it. So
here's a guy who got up, moved to, someplace in Thailand. I think he's in Asia. These people have nothing yet. They're happier than we are here.
Yeah.
Going back to the United States, there's two things I wanted to break down. Number one, going back to the women of the workforce. And number two, eradicating poverty. The problem that's happening is I believe that what you say is correct. Ontologically, women are childbirthing in their core. If they tapped into their own divine feminine, they would be the nurturers, the empaths, all these things. But they've been given a false promise by society that says you rise up to the ranks. They've been given this false premise that says, hey, these guys are a bunch of assholes. You can climb up the corporate ladder, make a lot of money, have the success, and obviously they're part of the workforce. So Even though deep down in their DNA, they're the ones that you're just talking about, the nurturers, the supporters, they've been given this false premise. And the same thing is going to happen if you eradicate poverty. If all of a sudden they're given something, our society has been shifted to need a bigger, faster car, a house, all these things that they're put in front of us. I get a new iPhone put in front of me every year. I've got to get the new AirPods. I've got to get the new wine. I've got to get the new golf clubs. This stuff is forced upon us. That's what this guy's saying in this video, and I'll send it to you if I get it.
Find it. I'll put it in this.
Yeah, yeah. The premise of the video was this guy was in Asia. He was living very cheaply. He was by the ocean. And Carnivore Aurelius talks about this too. He's like, get out, go by the beach, hang out with your girl, walk mm-hmm. in the sand, ground, eat right. good food. And this guy's saying that. That this country is so desperate for consumption that it's a striving. You go to that job, you live in the cube, you've been promised these things. If you do this and work your ass off for 40 years, you will have X, Y, and Z, and you're slaves. That's what he's saying. You're slaves to this machine, and it is a matrix of its own right, right? You do, and these kids are getting up on, they're talking about, oh my God, I was told, get a job after you graduate. I can't go out over the weekends. And it's really sad. You're seeing these good people who are trying to follow that dream and they're looking around and they're despondent right now. And so going back to what you were saying is if you could get rid of the poverty, let's not talk about poverty. How do you help that more of a middle class who can't make ends meet, who literally are people are having to get together, multiple generations of families are having to live in the same household in order to make ends meet? How are we supposed to alleviate that in terms of that next step?
Well, I think the first thing is we've got to fundamentally realize is that we've been on the hamster wheel for 40 years. You and I are a product of that.
Yes.
So really, if you look back at when Nixon separated productivity he separated dollars paid to the worker to the profit, and it was a shift to shareholder value. That's the beginning of the experiment with Milton Friedman. And for 40 years, you and I have lived an idea of what happens if you take off any kind of regulation to business and just say, keep producing. Well, guess what? The 80s were the birth of, wow, this is pretty powerful when you focus on productivity. And then the 90s was the burnout of that, saying, oh, but you got to keep the movement going because GE's Jack Welch says we just keep charging. And the 2000s was you got Y2K, and then the 2000s going, we don't really know how to handle everything. And it blew up with the housing crisis because we couldn't manage it. And I think that's the thing that we're realizing is we've been living a 40-year experiment that asks, can we keep the hamster wheel going? And the hamster wheel was our carrot. So your and I generation, the Gen X generation is, we lived the ride, but is the world a better place because of that? And I think fundamentally we're exhausting the idea that that hamster wheel can continue. And I think if you insert 30 million robots, you fundamentally create a crossroads to say, wait a minute, let's hold on. And I think honestly, going back to the first context, I think both Biden and Trump are a desire to go back to that old way. And I think the world is saying no more. And there's enough inertia that says, like Gen Z is like, I'm not going to work. I don't want to work. Like, because the carrot's not there anymore. They know it's bullshit. And our generation is at the tail end of it. We've gotten just enough. And most of the middle class is pretty much gone. It's got to start, the balance has to shift away from, I don't know, really the ethic of the entire process has been greed. That it's okay that.
Talked about this many times.
I think Elon and Larry Ellison, I think people like that who have the brilliance of that should be responsible for billions and billions of dollars.
Yes.
But we have to have a process or a way of operating that doesn't leave 99% of the people moving towards the bottom rung. And I think that is what is shifting. And so if you insert those robots, you take away the impetus to work, men are not going, it's going to naturally cure itself because we don't have to be buying into greed. It's an alternative that may shift the thing. And now I've got to learn how to have empathy because I'm not working as much and I want to actually hang out with my friends. But if I don't learn empathy, I can't hang out with anybody. And we're in an existential crisis right now that is profound. So, because there's
my hope is that AI starts to realize what they did in the fourth Matrix, where they actually ended up working together. Once Neo went into the machine and made a deal to be absorbed into the one, and took out Agent Smith, who'd become this aberration. Agent Smith himself had become this aberration, right? That was going to destroy everything, and the machine itself is saying, this guy's become unplugged. He's an absolute disaster. Okay, let's work on shutting him down. Yeah. And then obviously everything dropped. And then fast forward to the fourth one in Resurrections, where you're actually seeing AI working with humans. And I think ideally the scenario is AI gets so smart that they're actually realizing if they fail to do and to work hand in hand with us, that they're going to try to destroy it, that they're going to cause their own self-destruction, kind of like what we see on Terminator, right?
Right.
Where we're coming back to destroy that entire thing. And they did, right? And they destroyed Skynet before it actually came into fruition in Terminator 2. So that's my hope. But at the same time, Yuval Harari's out there saying, hey, there's going to be a bunch of guys out there that are just useful idiots for video games and whatever, and they're kind of unuseful. So, I mean, he's literally on camera saying, like, we can eliminate these people, right? They're like this massive humanity. So that's, talk about another existential crisis. If you can't provide value, then you're going to just be incinerated, you know? So that scares the shit out of me.
Well, it goes back to the World Wars. During World War I and World War II, an average of 1,000 people died a day.
Wow.
Think about it. Okay. So what's interesting is how much is not broadcast of like the Ukraine war and, you know, Israel's war with Hamas. The reality is that social media has fundamentally changed the way we share information. So bullshit can't travel fast. Okay. It's the world is starting to call bluff to say, hey, listen, what is the frickin' point of war? What is the frickin' point of all of this? Like, why are we doing this? And I think fundamentally the younger generation are waking up and saying, I don't want it anymore. That's what we learned from Davison last week or a couple of weeks ago, is they're saying enough, but they don't have the power. And I think what's going to happen over this next probably 3 to 5 years is we're going to see a shift to, from what I call competition. Like, the world is at competition with each other. That's the fundamental problem with capitalism, is it's always about competition. What about cooperation? What if the 99% said, screw that? What if we all got together and started creating cooperative economies that work together? We've got the robots now. Because I think what's dying is the dollar. Money as a concept is dying. And if you take that away, you start with a flat world that is very, very different. And I'm really curious. My prognostication is that in the next 3 to 5 years, we are going to see a massive shift that is going to fundamentally change everything we do. I really do. I think that. So.
Wow.
All right.
Good stuff.
Let's go a little bit lighter and talk about, so you wanted to talk about some nutrition. What do you want to talk about?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what's going on, and maybe this is just me, but I came back from the trip to Istanbul and Greece. And I actually weighed 193. So my ideal weight, if I could actually have this magic wand, I'd be 175. I'm sure you've got a magic weight too.
Yeah.
And I've had this just like everybody has at the gym. They're trying to put up two plates or three plates and you never get there. It's just that one mental physical barrier. Getting below 180 has just been impossible for me. So even having gone through ice baths and workout sessions, what I've actually come back recently to discover is, and it's a lot about what you've done, but I think it just, I'm trying to figure out if it's some additional supplementation. So I feel leaner than I've been before. I feel a little bit more ripped.
You look lean.
Yeah, it feels good. And maybe it's the shaved head, man, that's kind of put that kind of top down approach. But when I got back, I said, okay, I got to freaking get my shit together. So I did exactly what you did, where it's intermittent fasting, but I wasn't drinking. For me, the key thing is, and I can't stress this enough with all of the podcast listeners out here, if you get rid of alcohol out of your system, it's going to just change everything. That's the thing that nobody wants to actually fully agree with, because it's just such a crutch for us. But
why do you think for you?
Well, it's just a natural thing, because I mean, when you actually get to it, whenever you create an excuse for drinking, you do it. And what I realize is the reason I realize I'm not an alcoholic is because when my priority was for my head, that I literally had to not have anything days before and days after. Like I went 10 days without anything except for a glass of wine that they said, doesn't really matter. But those 10 days, I lost the pain in my shoulder that I'd had. And I realized if I had a cause that was good enough, I was able to adhere to it, right? And so what we have to do in our own mind is we have to look at the goal and we have to look at the overall health of ourselves, inflammation, everything, and say that that priority is going to transcend that friend's birthday in 3 days or 4th of July barbecue with beers and this, or Cinco de Mayo, because this is going back to this Asian guy. Our society has Merlot Day, freaking Taco Tuesday. Oh, it's tequila, right? There's literally in your face, if you're on Instagram, you're seeing a new reason to have a martini or something else, or a glass of wine, or celebrate your mom. And what I found was that first 10 days back, eight days back, I lost 8 pounds, Jonathan, and they went lower, lower, lower. And it was this idea of if I stop eating at 6:30, it's not even an 8 hour window now. It was like a 6.5 hour window, 7 hour window. I literally don't have anything except for a little bit of coffee, maybe a touch of cream. Mm-hmm. And then I have a smoothie like you did. I broke it up between having just a very high protein, like set of sardines and maybe some olives. Or just a light meal, or this. I think the smoothie is so key, because when your body is just craving something, it's got that liquid in them. Even if you have a banana, even if you have some carbs, it doesn't matter. And protein, that really just helps that process. And I went down to 184 within that. And of course, what happens the next weekend? Wine tasting up with friends and solving. And it became to me like clockwork. It was just a no-brainer. I know exactly the formula now. And I think that everybody needs to find that for themselves. But if they take that alcohol out of the system for 5 days, what ends up happening is if you do indulge over the weekend, then when you do it up again, it comes back into place. So one of the biggest barriers that I had was I've been, you know, let's say you've been on a freaking bender for a week and a half. To be able to come off of that and to see the results you want to, it takes so much more time. But once you get yourself into that, in that zone of like 5 days off and then two days on, then when you go back to that next week, then you see it work in that kind of that flow. Anyway, that's what I noticed recently.
Well, you said a lot, but I want to focus on, on the intermittent fasting part. I think there's two things that happened in your thing. One, you switched your diets. When did you switch to intermittent fasting? When you got back from Istanbul?
I've done intermittent fasting all the time, but the problem is that when you
did it intentionally different, you reduced the alcohol.
That was
the question is, when did you lose your weight?
I lost it when I got back. I was because I thought it was
lose it on the trip.
Well, it's because you ate a lot of carbs, right? I mean, every meal had rice. Here's and pita bread.
And I want to bring this up. European diets do not include processed foods.
That's true.
So European diets are very different than American diets because the food is not processed. It's, if you look at the labels, they're primarily whole grain elements. And so I'm wondering if the shift of the European diet flowed into your intermittent fasting, which is going primarily towards proteins. Because here's the thing. I think every human being probably lives in 10 pounds of inflammation. Because every time I've started a new because all disease originates through inflammation of the body. They know that now. It's very, very clear. And so every single time I've started an intermittent fast intentionally, I lose that inflammation weight. Usually it's like 10 pounds just like that. And then the real hard work comes. But the intermittent fasting, what I've learned is when you get into that process, your body really starts to look forward to it because it's developing a pattern and it'll follow along. When I was clear, and I agree, no alcohol was a key indicator, primarily because it converts to sugars, I think. That's just a guess. Your body gets into a habit, and I was losing a pound a day.
A pound a day.
Yeah, a pound a day. But I'm heavy. I when I started, I was 250. Now I'm at 230. So I fluctuate between 225.
Okay, so you went down to 220. Yeah, you went down to 220 at your best because I think you lost 30 pounds. And then, but that's still pretty good. You're only about 5 pounds above that, you know. For me, when I got down to my 182, 183 during my one fast back in the spring, I went back to the 190. So I hover now in the 190 area, and then I try to get down to the low. So my weight is less than yours, and yet I still have this bigger volume, bigger swing. Mm-hmm. It's because you don't drink as much as I do. That's the main thing, I think. You don't need to that much. We'll drink 4 times a week, you know, in this household, or more sometimes. I mean, it's not uncommon to have a glass of wine every day.
I will rarely. Or more. I used to drink wine pretty consistently. Since I moved to Discovery Bay, this is a drinking community. I'll drink on the weekends, but I try and limit it to the weekends because I don't like the inflammation. I don't like the hangover. I never get drunk. I never get drunk. I just don't like the feeling, and I don't like the feeling after the fact because it's primarily dehydration. You can feel the inflammation in your body. I'm lethargic. Yes. I don't like that feeling at all. But I do enjoy alcohol. I do. That's been sort of the curve for me, is I enjoy it, but I don't drink it that much.
You enjoy it as personally.
I'll have one beer, you know. I don't drink like 6 or 7 beers.
Having an amazing Cabernet with a great steak. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something that you can relish. You pair the two. But for me, this right shoulder was such a pain for me. And I was like, okay, what am I doing? I need to go to the chiropractor. I need to get this acupuncture, more ice bath. And I was on this trip. And imagine sleeping. You're sleeping in a whole bunch of different spots. We had a hotel in Corfu. We had an Airbnb in Istanbul. Then we had another Airbnb. Then I had a hotel. Mm-hmm. And I'm literally in random places on random pillows, which is always a problem. And I come back and I go, oh, there's no pain anymore. And then I was good and didn't feel any pain. And then, you know, you go into that bender weekend or so. And then all of a sudden, oh, it's back. Right. And it's that so easy to so maybe the other question I might have is, if you bring in one glass of wine into your meal so that you're having that glass at 6:30, for me, key thing with intermittent fasting, which is almost you can't break it. You have to be legalistic about intermittent fasting, Jonathan. You have to be legalistic, right? We don't like to be the idea about being legalistic. But if you really want to see what that autophagy and what that thing does, you cannot have any calories in between. And when you have that extra whiskey at 9:30 watching Game of Thrones or House of Dragon, that's what kills you. It's not even just the volume. It's that extra piece that you had of empty calories, that your body is fighting to metabolize ahead of everything else. And that's what causes it the next day, even in moderation. And so for me, it's both and. Yeah.
I think also going to the other side of the world probably put you in a different emotional state. You know, when going across the world to unfamiliarity is, it's a constant limit. It's called a liminal state. And what a liminal state is, when you, everything is brand new because you don't have the defense mechanism set up like you do at home. Like when you live at home, you know all the corners, you know everything, and you don't have to worry about anything. But when you're in a new world, you have to be present for everything. And I'm really curious how that affected your body. You know, like, did it distract you from, like, because the muscle pain is just something emotional, but you weren't focused on it and it went away. And then you came home and it, I don't know, I'm just guessing. But I think going overseas kind of took you out of your norm substantially.
Yeah. Yeah. It also got me into the nicotine.
Doing the intermittent fasting gave you a new process for your body. Are you going to stick with it?
I'm going to stick because this is, I know this now. And I think what the question I should probably try, what I should try to do to mix things up is like, do I do a smoothie all week? So sometimes I get tired of a smoothie. You are so good about that muscle milk and the protein and everything. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's like, dude, I would love to have that leftover carne asada with a few, you know, vegetables and some salsa and just, you know, something else. And so for me, I think one of the things I'm going to try is if I just in one entire week, I'll just have my almond milk, my 26 grams of protein, a banana, blueberries, some ice, and then maybe some collagen. Yeah. We'll see how that goes.
I think the hard part is one of the things that I realized that you just touched on is when you have the capacity to say yes, especially to really enjoyable parts of life, it's hard to say no. You know, like when someone busts out a really great bottle of wine or busts out a really nice tequila or a whiskey, it's like, it's hard to say no because that's part of the enjoyment of life. And I think one of the things that I learned through intermittent fasting was I've got to start teaching my body how to say no because I'm always saying yes. I'm always saying yes to the things that I want. And what is the cost of that to me when I'm constantly indulging? Because indulgence is part of life, but when I'm 255, it's starting to affect me. And I think that's the thing. There's tremendous value in just the process of intermittent fasting because it's saying I'm in control of my body. Because when I have, it's 9 o'clock at night, I get up and I graze. I have two chips, three grapes, a piece of salami, a chip. I'm serious, dude. It's like I just graze because I want flavors. And what I realized when I started my intermittent fasting, I said to myself, for 60 days, I'm not going to cheat at all. And I did it, and it was rock star because I put my body into a constant state, and then I fell off. And when I fell off, I stopped losing weight. So part of it is gaining the sense of control over our own bodies to say, no, I love carne asada, but not today. That's hard.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I would think, so what I did yesterday afternoon, which I felt pretty good about, is I had olives, a little bit of chorizo, some salami, and then I had, there was one other thing, but for you, instead of getting a chip, how about trying a Parmesan crisp, you know, which has a lot better for you, and it's cheese, and it's a protein. So maybe for you, it might be mixing that grazing up, right? So if I'm grazing, if you've got olives, dude, olives are so freaking good for you. They've got healthy fats. We used it when we were doing our 5-day fast. They're a great source, obviously, of fiber, and then that anti-inflammatory quality. Having that going with pork, even though it's nitrite free, is not the best, right? But so maybe you go with like a beef stick, a grass-fed beef stick, or something that to help fill you up that you know is also going to be good for you. Like carrots, maybe they don't work the same way. But I think grazing shouldn't be frowned upon unless it's really going to be detrimentally caloric-wise. Yeah.
And I think ultimately it comes down to, can I control my body? I think that was what I was really trying to dig into is I started seeing the weight really come off. And it was simply because I said no. You know, I did the work. And part of the journey for me is not just about how do I lose the weight, but why am I not losing the weight consistently? It's because I'm lazy. It was really hard. The biggest thing that I learned the last 2 years is that I can be lazy because I can afford to be.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And it's...
But what if you couldn't afford to be? Yeah.
But the value of self-control through that entire experience was infinitely greater than the gain from the carne asada. That's what I learned. Yeah. Is the more that I put my body under my control, the more I benefited from it. And it's what everybody is. When they go to the gym for 30 days, they don't do it for a week. They go for 30 days. They go, God, I love the way I feel. And that's the value of self-control, is we love how we feel. So,
yeah. Awesome, man. You'll want to talk about our, did you mention we've got a podcast guest next week? The guy that had that kind of talking about, he did?
Yeah. He said he didn't want to come on. I was kind of surprised. He was like totally jacked up. And then he said, sorry, I can't, I don't want to do it. Not like, can we reschedule, but I don't want to do it. So I'll.
That's really bizarre. I was really impressed though. You and I both commented on this with Brittany in terms of that, dude, there was something that came through. It wasn't just her actual physical words. There was something inside of her mind. It was so unscripted and real.
She was processing emotionally her own loneliness.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It was incredible.
It really was.
I wouldn't mind having her back on. I think she broke through, man.
You want to reach out to her?
Yeah. But what you said right there was, because what she was basically saying is, what if it'd be like having somebody in a coma and they're loving their world. You know that they're in a very peaceful place. Nothing else is going to change. They're going to die or something else. Would you wake them up? And they're saying, what if they are in this environment with healthy people and they're living healthy lives and they're doing this? Would you try to take them out of that reverie and maybe leave them alone for a little bit? There was just so many things going on in that post.
I thought it was excellent. I think we should see if she can come on. Because I think fundamentally, we learn a lot when we question our own assumptions. And that's what she was doing. She was saying, what is the cost of me believing that this is it? Like, what is, and the whole conundrum of, do I talk people out of their joy when I know they're not going to experience that joy after?
Yes. Like,
that was a profound thought.
Dude, that's union. This is what we've been talking about. This is maybe it's the point of the love that you talked about, where it's the meeting. It's like, let's just, can't we get along? It's that it can't be that simple, but it is. It's like unified field or the source or God, right? How about the same thing? We're in the same place. We're vibrating at the same level, and it's all about love, and it's all about union and peace with our fellow man, right? That's it. Yeah. Awesome, brother.
All right, everybody. This has been another. I love these topic episodes because they always get interesting. We always get to share our hearts. To all of our listeners, we appreciate you. Thank you for listening, and would love to know who you are. Please comment, review, and share. Subscribe to our podcast if you can. It's 4th of July week, and to all those out there, please enjoy. Be safe. Don't get hurt.
Be safe.
Any final words, Rich?
No, don't be like Ben Stiller in Tropic Thunder. He gets his arms blown off. So anyway, have a good one, everybody.
All right. Much love, everybody. Take care. So let's get started.